We all love Tom Gimbel, though, don't we, Tom?
I appreciate that, John, as long as you and Mary both love me.
Yeah, well, as long as Mary does, because she's the boss. But we're all big fans, Tom. We appreciate your insight. Tom Gimbel is the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network, and you're looking at the sort of trends in hiring in Chicago. What's the latest?
Well, we did a survey of several hundred corporate leaders, HR, finance, CEOs, and what it came back is that really a higher percentage of companies than last year plan on hiring, which is great news and probably a bit surprising. Now, the interesting thing is, while more plan on adding people or positions, it's fewer people in positions they plan on hiring. So last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe they were going to hire 50, 100, 150, 500, 1,000 people, and now the numbers are percentages of that.
So people are hiring, but not as much as last year?
Correct.
So that's the glass is half empty.
Well, it depends how you look at it. They're still hiring, and aside from big tech, we haven't seen a lot of layoffs. So what we're seeing is companies are bringing people on, and it's just not going to be the employee-driven market where people would say, I want to work from home. I never want to come into the office. I want to make $20,000 more than I was making last year. Those days may be behind us for a while, but the idea of finding a job if you want one is still out there and very accessible.
How do you reconcile that with what the Fed is doing with interest rates, with inflation? They're trying to slow the economy. How does this fit into all of that?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I think for a lot of people, it's hard to understand, sometimes present company included. But what they're trying to do is lower inflation. And the way inflation gets lowered is to slow the economy. And I think when they say they want to slow down the economy, it leaves a bad taste in people's mouths. What they want to do is slow inflation and make products that we use cheaper and get things back to normal. When you do that by raising interest rates, now money for companies to borrow at isn't free. And when that happens, that when they're financing a company that isn't profitable, it costs more money to pay off that debt. And that's why what we're seeing in these tech companies is the MO for venture capital firms has been, we'll give money to 10 companies. We only need one to hit. And if one hits, it pays for everything else and then some. Now you've got a situation where the money isn't free. Companies are laying people off. So if you want to work for the next great tech company, you're going to do it at a much lower salary and or you're going to wait a while. But there are a lot of companies that are hiring, as I just mentioned. My company in particular, LaSalle Network, we've never stopped hiring. We've never done a layoff. And there's a lot of air quotes, boring brick-and-mortar, old-fashioned companies that are really good employers and are hiring people right now.
Hmm. You know, I think it's kind of obvious, but maybe not. I like the way you put it, and we don't hear it reported that way that often. Maybe the administration or somebody needs to push that. What we're trying to do here, y'all, is make stuff cheaper, right? So as much as the reporting has been about inflation and interest rates and what's the Fed going to do, what gets lost in all of that messaging or all of that negative reporting, if you will, is the end game is to make stuff cheaper. I don't know that people appreciate that. That maybe doesn't make the process that much less painful for people, but that's an objective that we can all get behind.
Yeah, I think, you know, now we can go into a political conversation. I think both parties are too busy arguing over who's messing up more than to worry about speaking straight. And, you know, it's the current commander-in-chief isn't the best communicator we've ever had. Yet when you want plain speaking, we had George Bush II in the early 2000s, and he spoke too plain for people, and they thought he was an idiot. So, you know, sometimes people hear what they want to hear, depending on what party they're in. And at the end of the day, you have to realize, get a job you like, put your head down, work your butt off, have fun, succeed, get a promotion, yada, yada, yada. And the way things used to be weren't so bad.
Give me a 15-second answer to what's your advice to my son who graduated with a double major from the University of Illinois and still does not have a job?
So the question is, What does he want to do? Does he know, number one? Number two, is he willing to get his foot in the door the way when you and I got out of college a million years ago, John, we would have done anything anywhere, or does he have entitled beliefs of how much he should make? And I think if we can get past those answers, there's a lot of opportunity, whether going through staffing firms, whether going into call centers or customer success, or taking an entry-level job well below what you think you're worth. Like you even as a parent said, a double major, right? When we perceive that to be that there is an entitlement to something based on what they accomplished in school, I think we're misleading our kids.
I think you're reading this more harshly than I intended. I think a double major is laudable. That's a good thing. And I do understand the frustration. I do think that young people today, I'm sorry, aren't as patient as maybe we were. Their debt is significantly more, even though they don't have to pay it right now. But I every now and then do hear from, I'd like to know what those 2 degrees are in, by the way. But I do hear from frustrated parents about the inability of their kids to find those $60,000 and $50,000 and $40,000 jobs when they graduate. That's all the time we have today, Tom. Let's you and I talk about this maybe next time. Okay?
Can we do that? Can we start at this point?
Yeah. In fact, I'm very interested in this. So let's you and I pick it up here next Tuesday.
I look forward to it. Have a safe and healthy week, and I'll talk to you next week.
Tom Gimbel is the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Philip Weiss joins us now, the president of SciFarth at Work, with a description of a kind of employee that I don't think about that much. Philip, welcome to the show. How are you?
Great, John. Thanks for having me. We haven't been thinking about this employee in quite a while, and they've come back in a big way, concurrent with the return to work and more companies requiring more in-person presence. There's all kinds of dynamics that have reappeared. Kind of the BFF, your best friend at work, the water cooler gossip is a term we're hearing more of. But what the phenomenon that's perhaps most interesting is the reemergence in a big way of that one person on the team who's always looking to be the boss's best buddy, get all the attention, sort of, less charitably referred to as maybe the office kiss-up, but really this overbearing opportunist that rubs everyone else the wrong way, and they now have to contend with again for the first time perhaps in 2 or 3 years.
You described him or her as a human barnacle.
Yes. And that is what they appear to be, because they find a way, John, to really affix themselves to the side of the manager or boss. There might be the notion that we've seen where they park themselves in the boss's office before he or she shows up, so they're ready to have that informal chat. In one case, we have a client working with now. It's a rug company where the boss's pet, so to speak, would actually stake out the parking lot so he or she could corner the boss as they park their car and have that conversation one-on-one. So they really find a way to be that barnacle that's stuck to the side of the boss.
Well, what's the point of this? What's the harm of this? Doesn't that person do all of this at their own peril?
Yeah, that's been kind of an age-old question. And the harm that we see is it's acute when that person's not really a good performer, but they found a way to almost gaslight the boss through the flattery and the praise they dole out to everyone above their level. It's a cost to morale of the team, which is really an interesting byproduct. If the person is a great performer, so it's about performance and maybe some excessive praise as well directed at the boss, that's tolerable. In some cases, it actually reaches a point, John, where the people who are these bosses' pets or what you might call the kiss-up, they will begin to misrepresent their own contributions. So they're so used to advertising their successes that they will then inflate and in some cases misrepresent those successes. So there's actually a line that we don't want to cross, and that's where the damage may occur.
I wonder if people listening to you right now are inventorying in their minds who those people are at work. And I two questions. One is it you? And number two, holy crap, he just described me, some might say, if they had a moment of candor. And also, the boss might be listening going, oh, yeah, that's Bill or Lois or whoever. And So the question then becomes, what do you do about this?
Yeah. And I think that you've identified sort of this really critical evaluation. If you look at yourself and you realize you're spending more energy laser focused on the boss's whims, are you the one that brings that bakery delight that he or she loves every 3 days? That's an indicator, right? Are you spending more time at the bakery than getting to work because you want to please that? That's a warning sign. And you're right, John, from the boss's perspective, it's really important to make the evaluation because there are people that have cozied up to you who actually may be great performers, who may actually serve the team's results, meaning somebody that has access to the supervisor, they also have access to potentially good information or better resources. There have been studies done at a number of business schools that showed that project teams that included these bosses' pets produce better results in the eyes of managers because they sometimes could get hold of more information and better resources internally. So it's not altogether a bad thing for the team, but the managers have got to be thinking about this with a keen eye. Am I giving equal access to people? Am I sharing information broadly? And am I maybe pairing up that person who's the overbearing opportunist with somebody who's a real collaborator? Because together they can produce even better results. So there's a lot of evaluation here that can make a difference.
Give me one more example, a real-life story where this occurred.
Well, interestingly, the couple examples that I've shared with sort of the person cornering the boss in the parking lot or someone bringing in the treats with an extra large helping for the boss, those are somewhat benign in these cases. But we have another example, which is a company where it was actually a cosmetics company on the West Coast, where the boss himself was a bit all over the place, would issue a new edict or business plan or task list every week because he could not get his head around one approach. And unfortunately, that person on the team who was that overbearing opportunist was so interested in supporting the boss that he or she would find a business article or a study that supported whatever the boss came up with. So the boss ended up feeling like a true visionary because this one employee was so interested in pleasing the manager that they supported every single edict that came down. The rest of the team ended up so confused and so resentful of both the boss and that one employee that a third of them left. So the idea is if you only focus on what the bosses want, on his or her whims, to the exclusion of what's right for the company, you can take everybody down the wrong path.
And that boss's name was Elon Musk.
No. Well, you know, we can learn from many of these cautionary tales. You know, that's important. Whether they're in the news or they're in our own brick-and-mortar office, you want to look for the personality types and really try to conform to best practice.
Okay, that's Philip Weiss using the word of the year appropriately in this conversation today. Gaslighting, the president of Seyfarth at Work, seyfarthatwork.com. Always a pleasure, Philip. Thanks for your insight.
Thanks for having me, John.
Tom Fortino is the founder and principal of the Alpha Wealth Group. He's also the co-host of This Week in Wealth. That's Sunday mornings at 6:30 on WGN Radio. In fact, I caught your show this Sunday morning. I was up with my granddaughter, Tom, and I thought it was really interesting and also helpful because you have a whole half hour with Elise Glink to kind of get into some of these issues in more detail. It's a very interesting show.
Yeah, it's an opportunity to dig in a little deeper into issues, whether it has to do with charitable giving, as you're just talking about, or taxes, or income planning, and anything that has to do with personal finance. The good news is I think we're going to an hour starting in January, so at 7 p.m. or 7 a.m.
Well, well, that's
so you don't
all
have
time
to get up as early.
That's all the time I have for you today, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
At least it feels that way sometimes. What numbers are you looking at? What's on your radar today?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think there's this anticipation. Unfortunately, as we've talked about before, it's always, you know, we got to wait to see what the Fed does. You're going to have jobs report. So there's this data hanging out there. So I think the market, as you've seen today, is kind of languishing or just kind of holding steady. I don't know. I think, again, there's some waiting to see what some of these numbers are going to look like because they're pretty significant numbers this week, right? And so, well, that's going to maybe have an impact. Well, have an impact on the direction of the market going forward. So I think that's where we're at right now, kind of a holding pattern.
You said significant numbers this week. Which numbers are you talking about, Tom?
Well, I'm sorry. The Fed's. I'm sorry. I meant to say, you know, when you're looking at jobs data, certainly that's a big part of it. Then I know Powell's going to speak, and they're not necessarily going to make that decision. The decision. But there's things coming out this week that, you know, will have an impact. Certainly, we're waiting to hear those things. I mean, Bullard's come out, Williams has come out, Brainard has come out and made some pretty hawkish comments on interest rates. So those are some things I think the market's kind of waiting to get a little more of a solid footing on before we see, you know, movements in the market.
Jerome Powell's supposed to speak at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institute tomorrow, and then everybody will wonder what does he mean by whatever he said in anticipation of the number. You know, it does make one wonder, well, what are the fundamentals? I mean, do you think that American companies are, in fact, in a good position despite all of this rhetoric?
You know, here's the thing I would say. First of all, if you just look at earnings, so if you take a look at valuations and earnings year over year up 2%. Now, if you X energy, and you may have heard this has been discussed a number of times, earnings are actually down. So if you base it on earnings and valuations, you can say they're struggling. And of course, they are. And so the flip side to that is, you know, they're pretty resilient, right? You take a look at whether it's Disney or Microsoft or Amazon, you know, now Iger's taken over, they're cutting staff, they're reducing expenses. That's the one thing we can always say about these companies. There's ways that they do things to adjust. We're seeing a lot of that happen in the tech industries where they're trimming their expenses to, you know, help on the bottom line. So that's one good thing I can say. But from a standpoint of overall, no, these industries, there's a lot still left. I think there's some lag here to see where earnings are going to go, and I think it's not a pretty picture in the short term.
I'm reading from CNBC. Data out of Germany, Spain, and Brazil signaled that inflation in the country could be cooling as desired by officials. So as I presume they're telling me that other countries are going through this. Some of them are a little ahead of us, some behind, but that it's working out there, and one imagines that that's going to happen here, even if it takes 12 months. I think, who was it, was saying, was it Goldman Sachs, one of the big houses, J.P. Morgan, is preparing for a recession that starts in 2023, and according to Credit Suisse, they think it's going to last about a year. Does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, I mean, the thing to consider is while it may be ticking down, 7.7 was the last read on the CPI, you know, there's a lag. It's just not going to happen overnight. And you can even go back to the last, which seems crazy. It's been 40 years since we've had to worry about inflation or more. You know, in the beginning of the 80s, it was 3-4 years before those interest rates the inflation rates got in line. And that was with aggressive, you know, Fed policy. So, it's not going to happen overnight. It could be 1 to 2 years before you start to see inflation. So those numbers, I don't think are far off. I think it's realistic by what they're saying as far as when inflation may come in line.
Folks are spending money, aren't they? $11 billion was spent yesterday on Cyber Monday. I guess we'll wait and see what the Christmas campaign is like, but it does seem as though people are spending.
That's a true statement. The numbers so far have been fairly positive. I think it was over $9 billion on Black Friday. But then there's the flip side of that, right? The credit card debt, the highest. You're looking at close to, it's over $900 billion. It's up 15% over the last year. It's the biggest increase ever in 18 months. $197 billion, I believe, it's increased over the last 18 months. That's twice that. Two times higher than it's ever been, the highest rate in that period of time. So that's a little concerning. We're starting to see the debts rise. So again, there's these canaries in the coal mine, so to speak. And so we'll see how those things work out. But that is a concern. Where when is this money going to start to run down a little bit, and people are going to stop spending as much as they are?
So what do you do about all of that? Tom Fortino talks about these things on This Week in Wealth, Sunday mornings at 6:30, soon to be longer than that. And that's Sunday mornings with Elise Glink here on WGN Radio, 6:30 a.m. Okay, Tom, we'll be listening. Thanks for your thoughts today.
All right. You take care, John.
You too. More business news now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Ear piercing and jewelry retailer Claire's is diversifying its retail footprint. The Hoffman Estates-based company has opened 20 shops inside of Macy's department stores, including at Oak Brook Center. Cranes reports the Claire's shops opened earlier this month inside Macy's stores. The idea is to reach new and existing customers in more places. It's also part of the larger shop-within-a-shop concept involving some retailers. Ulta Beauty is another example. The Bolingbrook company opened shops inside Target locations. Claire's also has shops inside of some Walmart locations. A new report says restaurants in Chicago's River North were forced to cut hours more than any other neighborhood in the country during the peak of the COVID pandemic. According to Data Central, River North restaurants cut an average of 20.2 hours per week since the start of the pandemic. Many have dropped lunch service and closed earlier, not taking reservations after 10 p.m. The financial sector has largely maintained hybrid schedules, so fewer workers in the area has translated to fewer diners in neighboring restaurants. River North is right next to Chicago's Central Business District. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, business of food time. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yes, and our Giving Tuesday edition is sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. So here we are, Giving Tuesday, and a relative newcomer to the business of food and good is a charity called Rescuing Leftover Cuisine, which
is an organization that aims to make hunger a thing of the past.
Well, there are a lot of organizations with that goal, but Brett Carr says Rescuing Leftover Cuisine has a unique approach. Its drivers, mostly volunteers,
pick up excess food from local restaurants, cafes, catering companies, grocery stores, and other food-related businesses, and deliver those to nonprofits that in turn serve them to their constituents, their folks who are facing food insecurity.
And here's where this model is a little different. No amount of food is too small to pick up.
So if a cafe wants to donate 10 cookies at the end of the night, we'll make sure those 10 cookies get to the place where people can utilize them.
It's been gathering food in Chicago for about 6 months, but it was started 10 years ago by a banker in New York who wanted to do some good.
And we're coming up on the milestone of rescuing 10 million pounds of food across the U.S.
If you want to volunteer to drive, or maybe you're a restaurant or a catering company with food to donate.
Just like the name of the organization, it's rescuingleftovercuisine.org.
And there's an environmental piece of this pie, too. The food that you toss in the trash is not only going to waste, it is not helping the planet.
Food does not compost correctly in landfills when it's smashed down and buried. It actually has a negative effect on the landfills.
Now, there are many deserving beneficiaries of your money and time on Giving Tuesday. Well, on every day, for that matter. And perhaps rescuingleftovercuisine.org is a fit for you. From the farm to your belly, today's National Lemon Cream Pie Day. It's National Chocolate Day. And at the other end of the taste spectrum, it's National Rice Cake Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Let's talk to Jane Oates, the president of Working Nation, about the rail strike that isn't happening right now. Jane, thanks for joining us on WGN.
Hi, John, and everyone loves the way you read everything. I just want to clarify that.
Yeah. Well, I do a pretty good job much of the time, but not that time. Thank you for saying that. So Congress has the ability to forestall a strike. They can intervene, huh?
They can, and it's going to be very interesting to see what they do. In my mind, they have three options. They can force the unions to abide by what was the tentative agreement, that agreement that was passed by 8 of the 12 unions, or they can lengthen the cooling off period. They can say, you know, December 9th is no longer the drop dead date. And finally, they can force them into arbitration, which is a very prescriptive process where they bring in a mediator. And boy, I think it's going to be hard to do that. I mean, remember, there's 12 different unions. It's only 115,000 people, but they are represented by 12 different unions.
And as goes one, so goes them all, even though most of them do support the tentative agreement, right?
Yeah, I think 8 of the 12 have ratified the tentative agreement, but, you know, no union member, and I should be fully transparent here, I'm a teacher from the beginning of my time, long before I did anything else, and I was a member of the AFT and did have to strike several times when I was in Philadelphia. So I know how hard a strike is. I know how hard it is to make a vote to strike. Nobody's going to cross a picket line. Even those 8 unions that ratified are not going to cross if their other brothers and sisters don't agree to it.
And, of course, the concern is that this would hurt the economy at a time when the economy most needs it, around Christmas, and as we all struggle with the certain economic situation we're in right now. 24% is the offered pay increase, but that's not what they really want. They want the increase, but they also want more medical time and a more certain schedule, correct?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's unclear. I don't get into the, I haven't talked to anybody in the unions, but so I'm going by the same thing you and everybody else is going by, what they read. But it really looks like the many of these unions don't get any paid sick time at all. The money that, you know, all of us looking at that increase, you know, a 24% increase by 2024 looks amazing. And I think everyone, every union member agrees that's amazing. But having no paid sick leave, especially when you look at the brotherhood of maintaining the way those union members that are the people that are out on the tracks, fixing the signals, making sure we don't get in an accident, or that rail carriers that are transporting our food don't get into an accident. They had a horrible time during COVID, you know, and that's 23, 24,000 members. They say that COVID went through them like crazy, and it was really disruptive. So they really feel like they need those paid sick days to keep each other safe. You know, again, really hard to look at it from the outside. You just can't get mad at them because, you know, these people are fighting for their lives and safe working conditions.
We're on the phone with Jane Oates, the president of Working Nation. WorkingNation.com is the website. I'm reading from the Daily Herald, Marnie Pike's story. She said a strike would affect all major freight carriers, including the BNSF, the Union Pacific, the Canadian National Railroads, which have operating agreements with Metro. We would feel this in Chicago, huh?
I think we'd feel it around the country. I mean, it is, we as a country have gone through supply chain issues in the last 2 years like we've never gone through. First, we had the personal care products where everybody was freaking out and hoarding anytime they could find certain things. But most recently, we've gone through it with baby formula, right? We've all seen what young families had to go through with that. And I just don't think as a country, you know, we're ready to go through that. Just as you said, John, at Christmas, but it's also our food supply. Already, you see some companies moving, you know, to reroute the boats that are coming in to make sure that they're going on trucks rather than going on rail. And it's going to be a disruption. So I hope, I really hope there's some way we can avoid this. This is not what we need. I'm already, you know, getting indigestion worrying about this week's numbers day, you know, on Friday.
Yeah.
So we do not need this as we're trying to decide what our recovery looks like.
Congress has not, though, passed legislation forcing them to stay at work yet. I guess they could. We're expecting that any day now, then?
I think the most recent thing I've heard is the House is going to vote on it first and send it to the Senate. And it looks like, you know, as I said, I think they have 3 options. But do they extend it? Do they force an agreement that's been the tentative agreement into law? Or do they push them into mediation? I don't have any sense of where they're going, which of the 3 of those they're going to choose.
Jane Oates, WorkingNation.com. More information on that front there. Jane, good to talk to you. Very interesting. Thanks for your thoughts today.
John, always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me on.